Robodebt is the greatest public scandal of our time, no contest. With a whiz-bang computer program, the Turnbull and Morrison government supercharged the tired old coalition strategy of accusing the unemployed of ripping off the system. Over 2.5 years, $1.7 billion was taken unlawfully from 470,000 people on government benefits. Lives were destroyed. At least 3 victims suicided. A royal commission in 2023 described Robodebt as an extraordinary saga of venality, incompetence and cowardice. Financial redress of about $2.4 billion has been paid. And now, after much to-ing and fro-ing, the National Anti-Corrupt Commission, the NAC, has delivered its findings on the scheme's 6 chief players, including Scott Morrison. The recommendation, no punishment. It's so Australian. To discuss, I'm joined by Geoffrey Watson, SC, barrister and director of the Centre for Public Integrity and a fierce critic of the NAC, the Anti-Corruption Commission. Geoffrey, welcome to Late Night Live.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, David.
So the Royal Commission referred to the NAC the cases against 6 individuals up to their necks in robo-debt. Now, that reference was entirely secret, wasn't it? We didn't know the accusations against them until now.
Well, that's actually right. It was a special closed section of the Royal Commission report. But we now know what was found and what was said about those 6 people.
But why was it secret? Why couldn't this be known?
Well, that was a decision of the Royal Commissioner that this matter would be referred on to NAC. And the Royal Commission handed down its report in 2023. I imagine that the Royal Commissioner felt that NAC would move with similar efficiency to the efficiency she had shown and have their report out in no time at all. So I don't think she thought that it would be buried for 3 years.
Even the identities of the 6 were secret, right?
Yes.
But of course we could guess that they would include the minister responsible for the scheme, Morrison, and the chief bureaucrat responsible for the scheme,
Catherine Campbell.
Catherine Campbell. And that indeed proved to be true. So let's go back to the beginning of the scheme. How was it supposed to work?
Well, it was as a matter of probabilities, so that instead of looking at individual cases, a computer program picked up and analysed tax records, and if you were shown to have earned a particular amount of money which would otherwise, on the face of it, disqualify you from social securities, the program turned around and converted that into a debt. Now, that worked completely unfairly. Let me give you the most simplistic example. If you had a very well-paid job for 6 months in a year, but then lost that job and became entitled to unemployment benefits, under this program, it would look back and say, oh, well, hold on, during that year, paying no attention to the fact that you'd earned it in half a year, in that year you earned $75,000. You were not entitled to unemployment benefits. You were then issued with a notice which took the form of a debt owed to the Commonwealth for the whole of the social securities you'd received.
So if you got one of these notices, it was up to you to disprove it. They didn't have to prove a debt. It was up to you to disprove it.
Yes, and a lot of people who got it, we've got first-hand accounts. They didn't know why they were getting it. Some of them were outraged. Some of them realised it was an administrative error. But the group who was getting them were unusually vulnerable. They were people on social securities. Maybe they didn't have friends who were lawyers. Maybe they didn't have access to external assistance. And so they were getting these notices, and you can imagine the impact it would feel. I know how I would feel if I got a notice from the Commonwealth government saying that I owed a large sum of money, tens of thousands of dollars.
Particularly if you were, at the time, on unemployment benefits.
Particularly if you didn't have the money.
Do you repay it? So the notion was that if you earned a bit of money in the year, it was averaged out over the whole year, and these were, and it was declared that you owed money.
Exactly. And that, you can see, is just obviously prone to unfairness.
Prone to unfairness or not, even more obvious it would seem to me is that a brand new way of approaching getting government debts repaid, a brand new way, everybody would be asking themselves, Do we need fresh legislation to do this?
Oh, they were asking that question. Many, many people were asking that question. It was even called, it started in 2015, it was even given a title, the New Policy Proposal. So everybody knew that it was new. The question was it permissible within the existing statutory framework?
Absolutely fundamental question. New scheme, do we have to legislate for it? Did anybody say they did have to legislate for it, Geoffrey?
Yes, plenty of people did. For example, some lower-level bureaucrats thought it should. Some external lawyers, and this is a real problem here, not the government lawyers, the AGS, but external law firms had said, yes, you need new legislation, or it's not consistent with the current legislation, or it's illegal under the current legislation. So people were asking these questions.
But which people? Oddly enough, it didn't seem to include the minister, Mr. Morrison, or the head of the department, Ms. Campbell, or it would seem the cabinet.
Well, hold on. You're now reciting the findings of the NAC as opposed to the findings of the Royal Commissioner, Chief Justice Holmes.
I'm guilty of that. Distinguish the two, sir.
Chief Justice Holmes actually made these six referrals on the basis of findings that she had made that these questions had arisen and that people, for example, Morrison, knew enough to be asking these questions. I can explain exactly how that worked in practice. But the findings by Commissioner Holmes, if we just focus on Mr. Morrison, they're pretty serious. She found that he knew that averaging robo-debt was a bad scheme which didn't work, that he was the responsible minister for administering the scheme lawfully, that he was warned that it had been unlawful to introduce it, that Morrison omitted to tell the committee, the Expenditure Review Committee of Cabinet, that fact, and in doing so, he misled Cabinet, either deliberately or perhaps maybe through omission. That is pretty serious stuff. The Royal Commissioner went on to find that Mr. Morrison had given untrue evidence to the Royal Commission on a critical issue about what he was told about established practices. Now, that's one set of findings.
Which we now know for the first time.
Yes. So if NAC's report has done one good thing, we now know what these findings were, and they are really very serious. Now, as it turns out, the Assistant Commissioner at the NAC, Kylie Kilgour, did not agree. In fact, in opposition, preferred her own inferences or was unwilling to draw certain conclusions and came to different views about it.
So now we're moving on from the Holmes report, which was the Royal Commission, to the Kilgour report, which is the NAC's work.
Yep, and that's why I pulled you up before, because it's not really as though we've got the final word on this. What we've got is, in practical terms, a different outcome from a different person. One, Chief Justice Holmes from Queensland, and the other, Assistant Commissioner Kylie Kilgour.
Which of the two do you think displayed a better understanding of the public service?
I'm reluctant to really get into the personalities and I don't wish to be critical, but I will say this. The Royal Commission report was thorough, it was careful, it was comprehensive, and I saw no reason to doubt any part of it. I was disappointed that there was a sealed section. I thought we should know that too, but I trust the Chief Justice's judgment in keeping that from us. And also, there's something else here, David, which I think we might need to return to. I was also able to watch the Royal Commission proceedings as they unfolded. They were conducted in public and I could see it. Meanwhile, Commissioner Kilgour, very accomplished person, conducted her part of the inquiry in closed session. We didn't get to see it. We see reasons why Catherine Holmes didn't believe Mr. Morrison, and we also got the opportunity to watch him giving his evidence. Meanwhile, Commissioner Kilgour has believed Mr. Morrison expressly said that. But unfortunately, I didn't get to see how he gave that evidence. I could make no independent judgment of it.
The NAC has been much criticised for its reluctance to interview people in public. But there is a clause there that allows them under certain circumstances to do so. I would have thought, correct me if I'm wrong, that interrogating a former Prime Minister about a scandal of this dimension would open the door to those rare public interrogations.
Yes, well, I don't think they should be that rare, but accepting for the moment that the legislation says that they can only occur in exceptional circumstances, one of the governing factors you take into account is the public interest. Can anybody tell me of a more central public interest than finding out what happened in this terrible scheme, in this terrible administrative error, by a minister who later became Prime Minister of the nation? In fact, if you look at the report of the NAC, it's called Operation Myrtleford. It's on their website. Anybody can look at it and see that the last 10 or so pages explain why there were no public hearings. You could read those, I read them, and think the reasons given were good reasons why there should have been a public hearing. It was a matter of heightened public interest.
They proved the contrary case.
They do. I mean, I read them and I thought every single reason they're suggesting that it should be heard in public are precisely the reasons why it should have been heard in public.
There is some good come of this. This is not this the NAC report, for all the criticisms that we and other people have been making of it. At least the thing is done now. But is it done satisfactorily?
Oh, no, not to me. I don't feel like it's satisfactory at all. In fact, I've just got a lingering worry about this. I look at this terrible scandal and think hardly anybody has suffered for it except for the victims. If I look at the career of Catherine Campbell, who was the subject of very scathing findings by Commissioner Holmes, Catherine Campbell received a promotion, a high promotion.
And yet the Kilgour report exonerates Catherine Campbell to some extent on the grounds that she had nothing to gain from pleasing the minister or pleasing the government. She gained spectacular promotion.
Yes. It's actually quite interesting. Maybe this is just the nerd emerging in me, but when I looked at the report, I couldn't help but notice this constant obsession with looking for whether or not somebody had a motive. So that I checked on, I did just this morning, I checked on how many times the word motive was used. It was used 14 times in the report, and most of the findings have got a section titled motive. And the Commissioner Kilgour was looking for motives. Well, we know from lots of experience, hundreds of years' experience in this instance, that looking for a motive can be quite deceptive. That if there is an obvious motive, well, that sort of proves it. But the criminal law says that motive is never an essential element, and that applies with equal force to statutory corruption. So let's put it aside. That's deceptive. Yet if you look everywhere in the report, there are findings, well, there was no motive, and Catherine Campbell got the benefit of that. Well, excuse me, but I tend to think the opposite. The word fear is used 18 times, and it's used constantly in the context of people in the public servants who feared the consequences of not going along with what people wanted to have known. In other words, it was a culture. Between those two things, you can get motive, if you ask me. And also, the job to which Catherine Campbell was promoted at the end of all of this paid in excess of $1 million per annum. Oh, well, you know, maybe it's the cynic in me, but I do sense the potential for a motive.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Geoffrey Watson about the latest round of the Robodebt scandal, it being the report by NAC. Geoffrey, What does this report tell you about the future of NAC?
I've written about this, I've spoken about this, I think, on this program.
This is not your first rodeo on Late Night Live.
Yes. The point is this, that the culture comes from the top. At the moment, I just see everything about the NAC demonstrating that it is defensive, it's legalistic, it's very wary of making an error. Now, I can understand that. They're all good things.
All good things
and human things. But there is a problem with that. These sorts of agencies, it's very important that they are robust, that they are tough, that they are ready to lock horns with the rich and powerful. That's who they're mainly investigating. And what's more, they've got to be willing to have challenges made to it in courtrooms. That's just part of the job.
Could I put it another way, that they have to be real world?
This is public sector corruption. David, without a doubt, the single most serious crime in the world today. For example, the international drug trade doesn't get off the ground without public sector corruption. To investigate public sector corruption, you need special power, special skills, and you need to be tough and you need to be hard and you need to go after your targets. Everything about the NAC that I've seen seems to suggest that it's supine and reactive and wishes to take a conservative line when a more aggressive line is open. Now, I'm not just talking about this report. I'm talking about things which I've seen in print, which are meetings of the NAC executive over which Commissioner Brereton presided, in which they expressed to me, a misunderstanding of the jurisdiction. I should say I was there in the room when this jurisdiction was being drawn up.
Right.
It came as a surprise to me, and I rang some of the other people and discussed with them these minutes. We couldn't understand where this was coming from. And I've also written about this, but the Deputy Commissioner, Nicole Rose, gave evidence at the Senate estimates, which to me suggested that it was an organisation which was very scared of stepping out of line with testing its boundaries. I'm very disappointed at that. But if you ask me, that comes from the top. That's the culture created by the leader.
What about its legislation?
So there's nothing wrong with its legislation in my book, except for the clog on public hearings.
So the machinery is okay, except for that.
Could I tell you, I was there, we were proffering these matters as design, except for that clog on the conduct of public hearings. The designers, we were getting everything we wanted, including really good funding. So it is a properly funded, properly skilled investigative body, and at the moment, I think, just lacking in leadership.
Geoffrey, thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
You know, it's my pleasure. Thank you, David.
I have been talking to Geoffrey Watson, campaigner against corruption, campaigner for more effective corruption commissions, barrister and director of the Centre for Public Integrity. This is Late Night Live.